Hello and welcome to Radio Aldie. We're delighted to host a new podcast, The Odd Couple, sponsored by Bailey Gifford, starring the great broadcaster John Humphreys and Matthew Norman, Aldie columnist, formerly The Guardian diarist and Telegraph columnist. For over 30 years, from 1987 until 2019, John Humphreys was the chief presenter on Radio 4's Today programme. Now he and Matthew, great friends, often with severe differences of opinion, lock horns for Radio Aldie. Recording by Yamaha Music.
Hello and welcome to The Odd Couple. And you may or may not agree with that description of him and me. Him, of course, being Matthew. Me being me, John. And it's a podcast, but what does that mean? I've never, to be honest, been quite certain what a podcast is, but let's assume it's just a conversation between a couple of people. Occasionally we might interview somebody else or have a chat with somebody else as well, but for the moment it's I suppose, Matthew, is it too pompous to say it is your chance to get to know us a little better?
I think it's just too old.
Well, I was going to.
You nearly said old farts, and then you.
I nearly said old fuckers, but it's just two old timers chatting away. And if anyone else is interested, they're very welcome to join us.
Two old timers chatting away. Old timers, that's fair enough, I suppose. But we're both.
Well, it's all relative.
I am a little older than you, but you wouldn't think it really to look at us, would you?
Absolutely not. Certainly not biological ages. I could be your great grandfather, but thankfully we haven't not taken any blood tests today.
Yet, what are we going to talk about?
Well, we're going to talk today, I think, are we not, about origins. As with any great superhero movie, it all starts with the origin story. So I was rather struck by certain, hopefully superficial, but maybe not, similarities between the state of the world today and the state of the world when you came into it, which was some 82.5 years ago.
This is quite a long time ago, yes.
A world at war.
A world at war, 1943 I was born.
1943, with democracy up for grabs.
So we had a couple of years to go. Well, I think, I mean, I wasn't able to make any judgment at the time, but I think we knew we'd won the war at that stage.
But still desperate times. And,
Oh, yes.
Not, you know, I mean, with hindsight, it looks inevitable. But, if the Germans had developed some rockets a bit earlier, it could have gone, or indeed nuclear devices. So now we stand today, this very day, perhaps at the most dangerous moment in modern history, certainly since 1962, possibly since 1940. And there's a slight sense of maybe, not for you, having been born into it, but maybe for historians of déjà vu.
I suppose that the difference, the huge difference, is that our idea of danger... I, for instance, we lived in a little back street in Cardiff, and there was a chemist shop across the road from us, and we got to know the chemist quite well. Well, I became a young man, I used to be their messenger boy and things like that. But when I was a little baby, they had a cellar, obviously, to store all their stuff. And during the air raids, they invited us to use their cellar to shelter in. Mm. And I got taken across the road into their cellar. So my mother tells me, I don't remember it too well, in a cardboard box. And that's where I'd spend many, many nights in the cardboard box in the chemist cellar. So that was my experience of war.
Yeah,
from an early age.
Maybe it's time to start building a nice Anderson shelter now.
I'm not sure it would be a huge help, really, would it, given the situation we're facing?
Yeah. Anyway, so we're going to talk about your start in life, because I always found it endlessly fascinating. Which I think something people won't know about you is the scale of poverty you were born into in the Cardiff suburb or locale of Splott.
Suburb? That's a rather posh notion.
Yeah. Well, I think, yeah. Because people talk about poverty today and people going to food banks now, but the level of poverty that you endured was something that very few people alive today would recognize.
I think that's true. I think that's true. I mean, we didn't know we were poor, of course. I mean, obviously we didn't.
You must have had an inkling.
Certainly not as a youngster. As I got a bit older, and certainly when I started going to high school, as we used to call it in those days, at the age of 11, then I realised, because I was the poorest kid in my year and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, but as a youngster, no, it was just normal. We were poor.
But, I mean, poor is a relative term, obviously. Yeah. But you were, so you didn't have money for doctors before the NHS. You were born before the NHS, obviously. You didn't have money for books. Didn't have any books in the house.
Nope, no books in the house. First books we ever had in the house were when my father saved up. Well, he didn't save up because it was done on the Never Never. Mm. You get lots of people in those days knocking on your door and saying, would you like to buy an encyclopedia over the next 2 years or something?
For a few shillings a week.
For a couple of bob a week, and he'd come on Saturday mornings and collect them. And he bought us. The family, there were four of us, five of us at one point. My little, youngest little daughter, sister died when she was very small. He'd come and collect the money, and we'd build up the whole, all the Encyclopedia Britannica. And my father made us a bookcase, which was a good idea because you could lock the bookcase. Not such a good idea was that he was so proud of these Encyclopedia Britannicas that he would lock them away and then put the key in his pocket so we couldn't get at them. I mean, it's sort of slightly...
So they're really all ornaments.
It slightly defeated the object of the exercise.
And this was the only literature in the house.
That was it.
Of any kind.
That was it.
No, they had newspapers, which were probably used in the outside loo more than...
They were used in the outside loo, yes. They're very, very cold in winter. And when you had to wipe your bum in the South Wales Echo, it wasn't very nice, I can tell you.
No,
we won't go there.
So you mentioned your sister. So there were three... Were there four children? Or
there were five altogether. My smaller sister, she died. Yeah, she was a little baby.
And you were how old? Four or five?
I was three when she died.
And you remember that?
No. I would have been a bit older than that. Yeah, anyway, I remember it very, very clearly because I'd been sent out. It was a Friday lunchtime, and occasionally, not often, but occasionally, if there was a bit of spare money, we would have fish and chips from the fish and chip shop for lunch, or dinner, as we called it, on Fridays. And I'd been sent out for fish and chips, came back with the fish and chips, and parked outside the house was a car, most unusual, in Pearl Street. And it was the doctor's car. I went in, the doctor was there, my mother and father were there. My mother... in copious tears because the doctor had come to tell us that our little sister, the youngest of us, Christine, who'd been taken to hospital the day before, died. And obviously the effect on my mother was absolutely catastrophic, quite rightly so. And on my big sister, because, of course, Christine was Anne, my big sister, who was a wonderful person. She was her baby. But she died, I think, because of poverty, in the sense that she should not... We weren't sure what it was and why they wanted to take her into hospital. I think, of course, I was too small to understand all of this at the time, but it was a sort of gastroenteritis, some digestive problem.
Easily treated,
one would have thought. But what really, as I got a bit older and angrier, was that my parents weren't told what was happening, and she died without them even
because
knowing.
They were poor working class people
because
who weren't
they were
worthy
poor
of
working
any
class. Precisely that, treated with utter, I think contempt is probably too strong a word because it's just the way it was in those days.
Indifference, it sounds like.
That's maybe certainly the more polite, and the indifference, yeah.
And so presumably a few years later, after the creation of NHS, that they would have taken her to a doctor and they wouldn't have worried about the money and she might well have been cured very easily.
Who knows?
But this is a brutal time. I mean, some people would be shocked to think of a time within our, you know, within living memory when children would die for the want of simple, you know, very simple treatment. But it must have been much more common than one imagines.
Yes. Well, death was common. I mean, that's a stupid thing to say. People have been dying for quite a long time now, haven't they? We were just coming out of a war when I was a little boy, clearly, and most families had brothers, sisters, children who died in the war. So it was common.
Yeah.
We were sanguine. No, sanguine is not the right word.
Stoical, I guess.
Stoical.
And presumably it was never discussed in the house?
No. Oh, no. No, never.
It sounds a bleak household to me. I mean, I think your parents didn't exactly get on brilliantly from what you mentioned.
They never spoke to each other.
You never saw them address each other?
Not in any sort of conversational or friendly or...
So was it, John, would you ask your mother for the salt?
It was precisely that. If
God
almighty. We would sit at the table and that is exactly what they'd say, yeah. And I sort of thought that was normal, really. But as time went by, of course...
It's quite hard to shrug these things off, I'd have thought.
I think they have an effect on you, don't they?
They do, really. I mean, they pretty much set the tone for your own relationships, apart from anything. That's, you know, it's learned behaviour. So, I mean, did they literally never have a conversation that could be described as sort of normal marital
chat? I can't remember one. No, I can't.
And when did that start? That's before you were born, presumably.
Must have been. I was the middle child. I had an older brother and an older sister, and then there was me, and then were two others. And my younger brother died when he was in his 50s.
Yeah.
But yes, there were five of us at one point.
It does sound... irredeemably awful.
I'm trying to think
people
of reasons
think they were
why
happy, weren't it, they? We were happy, you know. But it doesn't sound particularly merry.
It was not a happy household. No, it wasn't, and I think it's slightly silly in some ways to pretend that it was. There was no love shown. Let's put it that way. The only time I remember my mother being sort of really sweet and nice to me was when I'd gone out and for some reason I had some money, by which I mean a few pence, literally, and I passed the pet shop, little pet shop on the corner, and there was a rabbit, and little rabbit, and I just thought, I want a rabbit, and I went in and said, can I buy a rabbit? And the lady said, how much have you got? And I looked at it, was about threepence or something, I don't know, very pissed. She said, yeah, all right, you can have the rabbit. So I took the rabbit home, and my mother was appalled, profoundly upset. And she said, you've got to take it back. I said, you see my rabbit? And she said, got to take it. So I did, I had to take it back, and that was the end of the rabbit. And that evening, and this had never happened to me before, and I don't think ever did happen again, but my mother came into my bed that evening, and she sat at my bedside, and she said, and it was the most intimate, I think, I'd ever been with my mother until many, many, many years later, of course. And she touched me, she said, I'm sorry about the rabbit, but rabbits being bad luck, and I couldn't have it in the house. And I learned much, much later that there was an incident with a rabbit at the time that my little sister had died and my mother, and that was it. And it was just fixed in my mother. Anyway, what a silly story.
So that's the only... No, it's not at all, because that is the only show of affection from either parent you can ever remember in your childhood.
That's strange, isn't it?
Blimey. I mean, people moan about their parents, but, you know, everyone resents
cruel.
Their parents.
I shouldn't give that impression that they were cruel, but they just... affection wasn't shown by anybody at all. I mean,
not presumably unique in that era.
No,
sort of stiff upper lip.
I suppose, and just it didn't happen. I mean, I can remember my father's sister, Auntie Molly, who was extremely large, and she was a fiend. I say a fiend. We did learn later because she had a tiny little two-bedroom house, obviously, and all houses were tiny. And it was always locked, one of the bedrooms, and there were only two bedrooms, one of the bedrooms was always locked. Years later, well, after she had died, we discovered why. Well, we went into the room.
I hope you're going to say that Molly was a dominatrix and kept all her equipment in the locker room.
I'm afraid I'm going to disappoint you a little bit, and I'm not sure anybody would have wanted to be dominated by Auntie Molly. Her husband, Sid, was literally about half her size and absolutely terrified of her. But anyway, we finally got into that mysterious bedroom, and it was absolutely full. She used to work at the local hospital as a cleaning lady, and we discovered that she'd been stealing stuff from the hospital pretty much every day of her life, and it was full, absolutely full. The bedroom was absolutely full of, and she'd sell it on there. The bedroom was absolutely full of soap and towels and this, that, and the other, all nicked from the hospital.
Any liquid diamorphine to go around?
Well, I don't know whether there was any diamorphine. Yeah. Not sure we had diamorphine in those days.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
So, and I mean, these are impossible things to be categorical about, but how much of your own drive do you think would you source to the misery and deprivation that you brought up in, desperate to get away from it? And
I'm tempted to say all of it, but that obviously can't be true.
There can't have been many people from Splott in that era living in that, you know, that level of privation who went on to be significant figures.
Well, funnily enough, one of my best friends as a little boy, Norman Rees, the name you
may... Old ITN.
Absolutely.
Legend, yeah.
He was, in some ways, even poorer than me because his father had died. I'd never met... Norman didn't seem to be quite certain whether he'd been killed in the war or whatever, but anyway, he died. And so it was just Norman, and they had no money at all. They were absolutely broke. Mm. But and I can remember many, 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 many years later. I was then the BBC's chief correspondent in the United States. I opened our first news bureau in New York. Mm. Norman was based there by ITN as their New York correspondent, and we were both New York, meaning we were based in the United States, where we worked mostly in Washington and all that. And I do remember we were both in the Oval Office of the White House, some big story to do with whatever it was, and there was the President of the United States sitting behind the desk, and Norman and I, with a couple of other hacks, standing...
When was this?
Oh, Lord, I'm hopeless.
Nixon era, was it?
Nixon era, yeah.
It was Richard Nixon.
It would have been Nixon behind the desk.
Yeah.
And I looked at Norman, and he looked at me, and Norman said, "Oval Office of the White House, there's the President. Not bad. Not bad for two kids from Splott, is it, boy?"
Amazing. So you started really with nothing, and the only books in the house were locked away from you. And you must have been a bright kid because you ended up at a decent, you know, really good grammar school. Doubtless feeling like an imposter and insecure.
I was the poorest kid in my class, yes. Yes. Yeah. And I was very, very conscious of that. Very good. I hated it. Absolutely hated it.
Yeah.
It was Cardiff High School.
Was it uniform? Called.
Did you? Oh, God, yeah.
And could you play? Mm-hmm. I mean, you had to...
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And that was a problem, buying uniforms.
Yeah.
And I do remember, this is a nasty, sordid little story, but I do remember one of my classmates, what a stupid word. Anyway, they were all posh kids. I thought they were all posh kids anyway, by my standards in those days. And he was the son of the chap who owned the very poshest gentleman's outfitters in Cardiff City Centre. He was very grand indeed. And I remember him saying to me, the boy, not the father, in school one day, "Do you know that your trousers smell?"
Mm.
I don't think I've ever wanted to kill somebody quite as much as I wanted to kill that little...
These yes.
...person.
Still, you know, remarks like that propelled you on your way.
Well, I suppose I did say, yes, if you've only got one pair, that... Anyway, whatever. Yeah, it was not a nice time, not a good time.
No.
And I hated it. I was very anxious. I left at 15. And
you left at 15 with a couple of O-levels or whatever. Equivalent.
Oh, you got, quite a few O-levels.
But you presumably you could have stayed on and...
They wanted me, the headmaster, would have gone Mr. Diamond, university. Whom I also hated. I got beaten because if I delivered newspapers before I went to school. I had three different jobs, one when I was in school. And morning paper round, messenger boy for the chemist, the people who sheltered me during the war, and I had an allotment to grow food. So I didn't have...
This is at what age? At sort of 12, 13?
12, 13, 13 on, yeah. 13, really, yeah. It started. And one of the problems with the paper round was having to get up early, obviously. And because I had to go straight from the paper round to school, I'd have to make my own porridge because nobody else was up in the house, bloody freezing cold house as well. And I had to make porridge. And I never did figure out how to make it hot. So I'd go off with cold porridge. Anyway, snow one day, very late, because late for school, that is, not very late, a bit late for school. And I got summoned to the headmaster's office, and he said, "Lay down." And I said, "I'm doing a paper round, the papers were late being delivered to the shop, and I had to, blah, 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 blah." And he beat me. And I thought, that's just not right.
Mm. Doesn't sound wildly unreasonable, no. 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 But presumably people were beaten the whole time.
Oh, yes, it was regular. Yes.
So, and have you ever regretted that then? You left at
regretted
15.
Regretted what?
That you didn't do A-levels, you didn't go to university.
Oh, I regretted it like hell.
You would have, I'm sure, walked into Oxford or Cambridge.
I regretted it like hell.
You did?
But it now, later, much, much later, but at the time it didn't occur to me. Mm. I was a kid from Splot. I didn't know anybody who'd been to university.
Yeah.
I mean, really? You just didn't. You didn't mix in those circles. It was a completely...
We seem to be... slightly coming round to the the circle seems to be completing its journey because we're now entering a world in which people from you'd have to be from quite a comfortable background to think against university because because you would be saddled with a 70,000-90,000 pound debt which is then massively increased by exorbitant interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
And B, what on earth is the point of having a humanities degree or any non-vocational degree now?
Quite.
So it could become again as it was in 1940, 1950s, something of the privileged middle classes and above.
Well, except that I wasn't held back from university because we couldn't afford to go. I mean, we couldn't, but nonetheless. But it was because I wanted to work. We needed the money. And I just, it didn't occur to me for a moment that I shouldn't leave school at 15 and start working. It didn't occur to me.
But the school presumably tried to persuade you to stay.
They had teacher called my parents in and said you should go into the sixth form and all that sort of thing. But no.
Were supporting because your father was. Could he see at all? I mean,
my father had been blind from childhood, yes, and he did have sight, not terribly good. Never drive a car or anything like that, but he worked a lot. Well, he worked hard. He worked very hard. Polisher,
right? But he needed a supplemental income. For the family.
It helped because there were times when there wasn't very much work for him because he was freelance and he had his own little business.
So you left at 15.
Yeah.
And became a cub reporter, yeah? Well, is that what they were called?
Nobody ever in my whole life used the expression cub reporter. You saw it in newspapers and things occasionally or in Superman comics. But now I became a reporter on the Penarth Times, which is a little seaside town just outside Cardiff. Yeah, and I did that for a couple of years and then I went to a slightly bigger... I left home at 17 and went to Merthyr Tydfil, up the valleys, and got a job. A much bigger newspaper than the Penarth Times, but I got a job there, also as a reporter. That was slightly different. Wasn't easy living there because accommodation was a bit of a problem. But
One other thing I think no one will know, almost no one, is that you were also a landlord and
I was
a landlady almost, given your cooking and everything. So you bought a house?
I didn't buy a house.
You were a teenager.
I didn't buy a house. No.
You rented a house.
I rented a house. Yeah, because I didn't have enough money to rent a flat or something like that. So what I did was I saw there was a house that was, I think it was £7 a week or whatever, rental. And I thought, well, if I rent that and then let out, it had four bedrooms, and then let out the other three bedrooms, that'll do, won't it? So I did that.
Where's this house?
This was in Merthyr. Just off the main street.
What is it? It's a four up, two down, is it?
Yeah, whatever. Four bedrooms, I know that. And it's incredibly scruffy. But nonetheless, I mean, we had rats. And I remember we tried to stop them getting into the kitchen by making sure the door was always shut. And then they ate a hole during one night through the corner of the door, of the bottom of the door, and they got into the kitchen. I remember the rats quite well.
Yes.
But yeah, no.
Sounds delightful.
So I charged them whatever it was.
What did you charge them?
Yeah, I suppose it was a
couple of quid a week.
Yeah, I expect it was a couple of quid a week. And I was earning £7 a week. So that was it. That was that.
And you fed them?
That became. I fed them.
Was this like, you know, cordon bleu cooking?
Cordon bleu cooking. Woolworths, Messrs. Woolworths and Company, because on my way back from the office to the house, I would pass Woolworths, and Woolworths did a wonderful line in those days of tins of food, beef stew, things like that. So I would buy a couple of tins of beef stew, and that would be supper. Yeah, for all of us. It was very, very good. We'd have fish and chips as well, sometimes, which we would cook ourselves. I had a chap living with me called Glyn, who had been brought up in a fish and chip shop, so he knew how to make chips, did Glyn? My God, he knew how to make chips. Vast quantities of them. And we had an Olympic oarsman staying with us as well, called Dave Huggins. Huge guy. My God, could he eat? We didn't like him very much. We put some of that nasty cleaning stuff in his bed one night when he was out getting drunk.
That sounds like an enchanting household, really.
it was interesting. We had quite a range of people.
You were the Basil Fawlty of... No, you were more like a sort of seaside landlady, were you?
I opened the door one day, knock on the door, and there was a very, very smart-looking young man there. And he said, I quote verbatim, "Hello, my name's Glyn, and I've just been around the world on my motor scooter." And there was his motor scooter part. And he had literally been around the world on his motor scooter.
That does actually sound like Rising Damp with you as a Leonard Roster.
He was a lovely guy. He looked very posh.
So you were always quite entrepreneurial in your small way.
Well, clearly, yeah. That's, I think, probably where my... business instincts began and ended, really.
Yeah.
But it worked all right.
And then not long after, and I believe, you know, you have a piece to be published shortly about it in the Oldie, which I suppose it sounds grotesque and almost wicked to call you a big break, but one of the great, you know, modern tragedies of British life struck not far away.
Abervan.
The landslide that took how many lives?
136 children, 28 adults.
Yeah. So 164 people died as a result, really, of grotesque of a criminal negligence.
Criminal. There is no other word for it. Criminal
this was coal, a slide of coal.
Waste, not coal, waste. The waste. When you dig out coal, a large part of what you dig out is waste, and that has to be separated. And the mines, the valleys, the Vining Valley, the mining valleys were lit up, both sides of the valley, there were great heaps of spoil that had come from the pits. This was a relatively new spoil tip, only a few years old, but there was a lot of it. 100,000 tons or whatever. And the miners who lived in Merthyr Vale, which was the little village at the bottom of this hill, knew that there should not be a waste tip at that particular point, because there were springs, water springs, beneath the hillside.
Well, that would cause it to sort of implode.
And when it rained, the water would rise and undermine the tip.
And then there would be a slide,
And I know this was that they really did warn at the call board. I saw the letters many, many years, well, a long time later. And what happened on that particular morning was exactly that. The water rose just as the miners had predicted, and the tip slid down the hillside and crushed, cliche, but I know, but crushed everything in its path. I mean, you imagine 100,000, and it moved. The miners down in the colliery, at the coal face at the time, deep, 1,000 feet below ground, heard it from 1,000 feet below ground. One of them said at the time, he said it sounded like an express train roaring down the valley, which it was. I mean, there was a roaring noise as it came down. And, of course, it crushed everything in its path, including the school. And, when I got there on the morning that it happened, I was the first person to get there because, obviously, I knew.
So you were how old? 22, 21, 22?
21, yeah.
On which paper? On the Merthyr?
No, I was working for television then, for TWW. I had left Merthyr. Right. I'd gone to work for the Western Mail, got offered a job on the Sunday Times, turned that down, and went to TWW, Television Wales of the West. Instead, I was working for them. And I said, can I go and attend to the boss in the morning? I was looking at the PA, what do you call the machines?
Ticker tape.
No, it wasn't ticker tape. It was the
telegram or whatever. The wire.
And on that particular morning, it was about 9:15, I was looking at the wire services copy, and there was a little story about a coal tip sliding in the Merthyr area. And I knew the area well, and I wanted to have a look at it. And I said to my boss, can I go? And he said, no point, these things. Anyway, I did go, and I drove up the valley. And, when I got there, I tell you, I knew it very well. I'd stayed there with friends. Well, my friend, one of my closest friends. The village was obviously crushed. A huge part of it was crushed. And there were mothers, hundreds of mothers with their babies standing, watching their husbands, the miners, on the top of this great heap with shovels and spades. They couldn't use heavy machinery because of crushing, and the children were underneath this mountain of waste, and they were digging with their hands and their picks and shovels. Looking for the bodies. They did find some. They found some children that were still alive, six, 7 years old. Yeah. One of my abiding memories at the time was a big policeman with his helmet on, carrying a little girl who'd been dug out by the miners. But it was just seen in the ultimate. The miners' faces were still black. I mean, when they heard it, the roaring coming down from the they knew instantly what had happened, and their faces were still black, of course, except one of the little lines of white on either side of their cheeks,
The tears rolled away.
And
the dirt.
It was the I've seen quite a few horrible things in my time, but nothing to match that, I imagine.
How long were they digging?
Well, they
would. A couple of days.
They would, yes. I mean, a couple of days altogether. I mean, it was by the time the end of the first day that they knew there was they weren't going to find any more anybody alive, any children alive.
And no doubt nobody went to prison.
Ah! Lord Robins, the chairman of the National Coal Board, which was entirely responsible for every nationalised coal mine in the country, had far too busy. He had to go to somewhere to collect, to be honoured as the Chancellor of, I think it was Surrey University, so he was too busy to attend. The Queen went, of course the Queen
went. I think it was shown in that series of Crown, wasn't it? It was a whole episode about it.
Yes, there was, and it was absolutely spot on. And, of course, Robins and his bunch of morons should have gone to jail, but they didn't. I was there, I have to
say,
when the inquiry was held, of course, I was there, I sat through it all, and I have to say, watching Robins being still to his last breath saying, no, it was the right place to do it, and we were never warned, blah, 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 lying through his teeth. And, of course, he got off. I mean, he was disgraced by the whole nation, regarded him as a monster, which he was, but he got away with it. Damn it.
And from that moment, presumably, your ascent was sort of supercharged.
Well, I suppose it makes, you know, it's a horrible thing to say, but when something, you know, when you've got what was the biggest story in the world for a while,
Did you find it easy? I mean, was it real? Did you have to consciously sort of fight back your emotions to report on that? Or did something. Is there, because I've not done that sort of reporting, is there some sort of level on which instinct takes over and you.
I think the latter. I think it just simply, you just do it. The first thing I did, because I didn't have a film crew with me or anything like that, obviously, I was just there by myself, and there's a pub that overlooks that bit of the village, and the barman let me use the phone in the pub, because obviously no mobiles or anything like that, and I did a broadcast to TWW, and that was broadcast throughout the world. I mean, it was it was a very, very, and I didn't have time to write anything or prepare anything. I just described what I was seeing.
Yeah,
as I just tried to describe.
It's partly a natural.
It is a
natural gift, really.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it's not difficult. It's not. It really is the oldest cliche in the book. It's being in the right time.
Not difficult
if
it comes easy.
Well,
there aren't that many people who can do it.
Well,
And from there, then that's what presumably caught the eye of the BBC, was it?
Could be. I got offered a job at setting up a BBC bureau in Liverpool, which I did, and then I became their Northern Industrial Correspondent, and I went down to London, and then I went, I was set up a bureau, news bureau in New York, a small patch, a modest little patch. It was from the North Slope of Alaska, where I did go, actually, first reporter there, down to Tierra del Fuego. So it was about half the world. That was my patch.
Right, we'll come back to that in future broadcasts, I heard. But quite an extraordinary journey, really, already, from the absolute dirt poverty of Splot to the BBC, an unusual one, and a much more unusual now, probably, than then.
Well, you'd have to go to university now, wouldn't you, for a start? I mean, you would go to university now. There'd be no question about that, would there?
I don't know if you can get on in journalism now without it, no.
It's unlikely, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think that's a good thing. Have we overdone? Do we send too many kids to university? You went to university, you're a very clever man.
Well, no, I mean, I came from about as different a background as you could find.
Well, you're a middle class.
Yeah, but I mean,
did you know you were middle class?
Well, I was aware of poverty at an early age. Yeah, yeah. I went to East Africa when I was 9, I think, and saw appalling poverty. It's pretty obvious that people come from exceedingly different backgrounds. So yeah, a life of, really embarrassing privilege, you know, compared to yours.
Were you embarrassed at the time? I mean,
I think always embarrassed to go to private schools.
Ah,
yeah, and guilty.
Oh, did you?
And found them repulsive. Yeah, the whole. I'm not them personally, but the.
Because you went to Westminster, didn't you?
I did, but when I was at school, we kind of assumed that by the time we had children, that only snobs would send their kid because the state system would be so good, you know, like as in first world countries, Germany or Netherlands or Denmark. But yeah, so it was a life, you know, a really nice house in a lovely, beautiful part of London, and. Mm. Nice holidays, and it couldn't be much more different.
But you say you felt guilty.
Well, I think anyone should feel guilty if they have an easy life. Well, most people have a
Well, only if you're aware of it, and if you never came into, as you say, not until you saw poverty, real poverty, proper poverty, disgusting poverty.
Well, even then, you know, London in the 70s, late 60s, 70s was one of quite dramatic contrast. And there was still, still poverty. It wouldn't have been anything like 1943, obviously, but it was still there. And to have a life, you know, like I did, was an embarrassment. I mean, a pleasure, but I think one should feel guilty about privilege.
I always assumed that the middle class were sort of not aware of us. I think I felt that. To the extent that I thought about it at all, I think I did feel that. That they didn't sort of... And I think
about the Labour ministers, a lot of them were from privileged backgrounds. It's not, indifference is not a guarantee of having a nice start in life, is it?
That's certainly true. Look, we've more than run out of the allotted time, whatever the allotted time is. And we're not just going to talk about me, we are also going to be talking about you and about lots of other things.
I hope so. Yes, we could just have the same conversation every time.
But we could repeat the...
Who knows, that might get a little stale.
Might become a bit tedious.
I think other things is good.
Other things is good. And if people want to get in touch with us, I'm sure they could do so.
Yes, and they will be informed at the end of this broadcast, I'm sure.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, thank you if you have
thank
been
you,
for listening.
John.
And thank you, Matthew, for being so inquisitive.
Well, I find it absolutely fascinating, partly because it's so unfamiliar, but partly because it is really genuinely intriguing little slice of social history.
You've probably never been nice to me before.
And I think it's unlikely it will be again, but let's kick off as we mean not to go on, shall we? And I will see you here shortly for another one.
Indeed, look forward to it.
All right, take care.
You have been listening to Radio Aldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Aldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.